thank you for the invitation to give this talk. I'm very happy to be back in PI. This talk is based on partly an older work that William Donnelly and I worked on about entanglement brains and some ongoing work that we're finishing up now. So I wanted to start with some general discussion about entanglement. So entanglement is related to some questions about locality in quantum mechanics. For example, what makes an entangled state special is that, unlike this unentangled state here, this EPR state can allow Alice and Bob to teleport a qubit using only classical information, classical communication. So it means that in quantum mechanics, quantum information is not localized. Because entanglement has something to do with non-local elements of quantum mechanics, it's useful in various contexts, like in the study of topological phase, where there are no local order parameters. Entanglement, in particular, topological entanglement entropy is an important order parameter. It characterizes many body localized phases, and is also believed to be an essential ingredient from which a smooth space-time can emerge from quantum mechanics. So to talk about non-locality, first I have to tell you what I mean by locality in quantum mechanics. The best notion I have of that is factorization of the Hilbert space. What I mean by that is I want to think that I can break up space into small subregions and attach a Hilbert space to each subregion and say that the total Hilbert space is just a tensor product. Among other things, this allows me to define a local operator that acts only in a small subregion. But this assignment of locality is not a God-given thing. Given exactly the same Hilbert space, you can have different notions of locality. My favorite example is the Hilbert space of free fermions, of n free fermions given by these anisymmetric wave functions. The fermions live on a circle, here labeled by angle theta. On the one hand, there's a natural notion of fermions living on this circle parameterized by z, but there's a completely different way of thinking about it. If I think about un, Yang-Mills, where this n of the gauge group is the same as the number of fermions, the configuration space variable is this holonomy going around a circle that I've labeled by coordinate x. If I diagonalize this matrix, the eigenvalue z here can be thought of as the same as the z's appearing in the argument of this wave function. In other words, the Hilbert space of U and Yang Mills is actually the set of class functions. They're functions of conjugacy classes of U, which only depends on these eigenvalues. And there we have a different notion of locality. In Yang Mills, locality means taking this element U of a gauge group and thinking about it in terms of the local gauge field A, which lives on this circle. Given these two notions of locality, there's a completely different answer for the entanglement entropy. But the Hilbert space is exactly the same thing as an abstract vector space. Questions of locality is also important in ADS-CFT. There we have a statement that quantum gravity in an asymptotically ADS space-time has Hilbert space that lives at the boundary at asymptotic infinity. But this statement by itself doesn't answer many of the essential questions we have about quantum gravity. In particular, we want to know exactly how this approximately local space-time emerges from this quantum mechanics at the boundary. The program that tries to understand bulk locality has been pushed in many directions. There's this notion of subregion duality in which you assign, you look at some subregion in the boundary and you ask what is the bulk region dual to that boundary, and the answer is this entanglement wedge here. And so these authors have made some contributions to this dictionary, one involving quantum error correction, the other involving the equality of the boundary relative entropy with a bulk relative entropy. Now, I actually just mentioned this ADS CFT because I wanted to, again, go back to my favorite example of the free fermions. There's another Hilbert space of free fermions living inside the boundary theory in N equals 4 Young-Mills. There's a sector of this N equals 4 Young-Mills consisting of zero modes of the scalar fields that are described by free fermions in a magnetic field in the lowest Landau level. That's just a quantum Hall problem. We have two-dimensional fermions, and they live on this plane here, and a state is described by a droplet, which tells me what area of the plane is occupied by fermions. However, Lin, Lunan, and Maldacena showed that there is a whole 10-dimensional type 2B geometry associated with these states. And that notion of locality is certainly not what you would naturally expect from this picture. So now, I want to go back to the question of Hilbert space factorization. This is actually a bit of a myth because, in general, the Hilbert space doesn't factorize. There are two obstructions. One is that a subregion has a boundary, and so it has edge degrees of freedom. And in fact, even for scalar field, there are these edge modes that live at the boundary. The other problem is that the degrees of freedom in the different subregions are not independent. One reason that's true is that in a continuum quantum field theory, the field values on this on one side and the other side of this cut here have to be correlated. The other reason is in a gauge theory, there's this Gauss law constraint, which makes the degrees of freedom not independent, even on a lattice. And the extended Hilbert space construction is a way to solve this problem by combining these two apparent obstructions into a solution. So here's a list of people who have worked on this construction. I want to explain a little bit about what that is. So imagine I have some gauge theory, and because of Gauss's law, the physical states consist of closed loops. But now I'm asked to divide space into two separate regions, V and V bar, and that division, that entangling surface, has to cut some of these loops. So the best I can do is to embed the physical Hilbert space into a larger space as a tensor product. The actual physical Hilbert space itself doesn't factorize because of these strings that are cut by the entangling surface. But here, I have two Hilbert spaces, HV and HV bar. Each of them have boundaries. And open strings are allowed to end on them. What that means is that there are edge modes living here, corresponding to the endpoints of the open strings. And these edge modes transform under some boundary symmetry group I call GL and G right. That's just, so in some sense, a gauge group restricted to these boundaries. And what Gauss's law says that is that to select out a state from this physical Hilbert space, I have to solve some constraint. And this constraint just guarantees that the state will be invariant under a diagonal action of this boundary symmetry groups that's acting simultaneously on the two boundaries. So it's just telling me that the open strings glue together to form a closed string, and the edge modes are what you need to do that gluing. Once I have this kind of tensor product factorization, I can talk about tracing out a subregion V bar to get the reduced density matrix, and I can define the entanglement entropy as the phenomenon entropy of that reduced density matrix. I should also say that the way in which we fuse together these two Hilbert spaces to make the physical Hilbert space goes under the name of entangling product, which Will Donnelly and Lauren Friedau have worked on. So, we have extended the Hilbert space, and in doing so, allowed a factorization and allowed us to talk about entanglement. But I didn't. But there's some question here about what rules, what are the rules we should use to determine the correct extension, right? Can I just arbitrarily extend my Hilbert space and embed it into an arbitrarily large, larger space, and then define entanglement by tracing over states there? So Will and I, in two dimensions, find a way to understand this, these rules by embedding this Hilbert space extension into the framework of extended topological quantum field theory. And the key insight is this. In this story about entangling products, we have two Hilbert spaces at constant time, say of two intervals. And we fuse them into a larger interval. But it is useful to think about this fusion in a space-time process. Now the path integral, the claim is that the path integral, doing the path integral on this picture actually implements this kind of fusion, but in that sort of Euclidean space-time. And this is the object that belongs to in the framework of extended quantum field theory. So let me say a little bit more about why the path integral gives you a space-time interpretation of Hilbert space factorization. If I wanted to prepare the ground state of a QFT, one way to do it is to do the Euclidean path integral from time equals minus infinity to time equals zero. Here I've chosen as my space an interval oriented like so. Now this state is not normalized, it's just the path integral. If I want to understand how this state is entangled between the left and right side of the interval, what I do is consider the angular quantization of this space-time. Instead of thinking about constant time slices being horizontal, I can think about these angular time slices. And to define this angle, I have to sort of open up the entangling surface. I do some kind of regularization. This is also what I need to do to talk about tracing out V bar, because the point in the middle here is shared by V and V bar. So before I talk about tracing over half the degrees of freedom, I have to tell you a prescription for what to do with the point in the intersection. And what this angular quantization means is that I should really think about this state as an amplitude. So here I've written the sort of tensor factorization of the state, represented by this path integral with a hole. If I think of, I can always think about this state as an amplitude by sort of flipping a rod to a ket. And this J operator is the operator that I need to take care of the change in orientation. If I think about V bar in the larger interval, it has its orientation with arrow going to the right. If I rotate it all the way over to V, then it's going to point the wrong way. So there is some issue with parity and time reversal we have to take care of. But other than that, what I've written here is just the path integral evolution in angular time. And the generator is what I call the Mollinger Hamiltonian HV. And the point here is that if I diagonalize this Hamiltonian, what I get is this Schmidt decomposition of my wave function. It's an explicit, what I did was really sort of diagonalize the amplitudes of this tensor product. And this is just an illustration that when I dig a hole in a path integral, what it does for me is it tells me how to factorize the state on the whole interval. And in fact, if I want to think about quantities like entanglement entropy, the object I should think about is the density matrix. Here I put a little tilde here because this is unnormalized. And the density matrix is obtained by taking two copies of this state. One is the ket down here, the upper one is the bra, and I trace over V bar. And what I get is some path integral on the space-time that looks like an annulus. And I can define a thermal partition function if I take the trace of this density matrix. It is just a path integral on this annulus, and the entanglement entropy just comes from the thermal entropy of this partition function. So once we understand that this kind of modular flow, so I should just make the point clear. So what I'm thinking of here is that this picture of this open string pair of pants is really this Euclidean path integral. At time equals minus infinity, I have one full interval. As I evolve upwards, there's two distinct intervals. So once I believe that modular flow is really should be understood in terms of this kind of pair of pants diagram, I can embed this whole story into the story of extended TQFT.
So are you using topological endurance there? Because you give up non-zero energies in the formula. So here you're not talking about TQFT yet?
No, this is totally general.
Yes.
This would work also for TQFT like Trans-Simons theory, except that these this Mollinger Hamiltonian is going to be restricted to the edge of the interval, or the edge of the region V. But so this formalism of extended QFT, the general philosophy is that we want to understand a path integral on a general space-time by cutting it up into smaller pieces. So one might start by thinking about cutting on codimension one slices, so these would be these circles. And what I see is a pair of pants, a closed-string pair of pants, and a disk, a hemisphere. And if I can understand the path integral on these smaller components, I can understand path integrals on general Riemann surfaces. But there's also a generalization of this story where I now keep on cutting. Now I cut the circle along points and get an interval. And from interval, I can cut into two smaller intervals. And once I allow for these kind of cuttings, I can really break up, now I can break up a Riemann surface into objects like, into smaller pieces like this. I can really open up this Riemann surface into not only circles, but intervals. The particular type of extended TQFT we're interested in is was developed by Moore Siegel, who axiomatized this cutting and gluing of path integrals. What they were trying to do is give rules for classifying D-brains. And for them, in this example, D-brain is really a category of boundary conditions, which is a labeling you assign to these intervals. And in fact, this picture, you can think of it as sort of an open string worksheet. So these labelings are just labeling the endpoint to the worksheet of the open string, and the endpoint of the open string is ending on these D-brains. But since we decided that modular flow is also about this kind of cutting and gluing, we can relate these two stories. So what we did was to interpret this Moore Siegel brand of extended TQFT as classifying not D-brains, but classifying extended Hilbert spaces and their edge modes. In particular, we chose to formulate two-dimensional Yagnos as an extended TQFT. We introduced an extra axiom that we call the entanglement brain axiom, which I'll explain momentarily. And this framework, beyond some conceptual understanding it offers, actually allows us to do exact calculations of multi-interval modular flows and also negativity. So let me pause here to see if any questions. Go ahead.
Sorry to get asked this a lot. So 2D Yagnos is, as far as I remember, not quite a TQFT because it's at its partition function depends on the area of the
map. Yes, yes.
So why is that, and why can you treat it as a TQFT here?
So it ends up happening that we can take care of the area factor. I mean, so I will show explicitly that we can formulate 2D Yagnos inside this framework. But I think the idea is that it's true that a topological three makes these sort of cutting and gluing rules easy to axiomatize. But I think in principle, you should be able to think about this for a general QFT, like a CFT. It's just that I think the program is more difficult. So in the case of 2D Yagnos, it's almost topological, right? It's just that in some sense, you have to attach some area factors to each one of these pictures. Each one of these pictures is assigned something that depends on its area, but when you glue together things, area just sort of add up. And we show that it's not a problem. So here's an outline. I want to first tell you about what open-closed extended TQFTs are. This is the Moore Siegel brand of extended TQFTs. And then we'll talk a bit about entanglement brain, and then these other topics. I'm sorry, was that a good answer to your question, or do you want, is there?
Well, I'm open to seeing what happens.
Okay.
Okay. You just have to divide by some overall factor. That depends on.
Yeah, so you're attaching some extra area Boltzmann factors to each of these basic pair of pants, dependent area, and you might worry that, oh, what happens when I glue them together? And the point is that there's a consistent way when you glue them together, modify the Boltzmann factors, the areas add, and it's all okay.
Maybe another way to do this is you can start with the, in some sense, you can start with the TQFT, which is like the weak coupling limit of the Yagnos, and then perturb it by some operator that turns on the area. It's just sort of useful to have the area around because it regulates things in the case of a compound. Because you have divergence in the GQFT.
Nice. But like, if you were to apply something similar, like the 3D transcendence, let's say, like that, then be or nicer DQFT, let's say the toric code.
Yes.
Would that be okay? Like, would that?
That's right. You wouldn't. Like,
you don't need the area.
No, you don't. You don't need it. You do in this example, but in general, in these
yeah.
nicer behave things, you don't.
Right, so so I want to start with the TF formulation of topological quantum field theory, in particular in two dimensions. The way he wanted to think about a TQFT is a rule. It's a rule that assigns to one-dimensional closed manifolds a Hilbert space over the complex numbers. So here's a closed manifold in one dimension, it's a circle, it's assigned to a Hilbert space. If I change the orientation of a circle, I go from the Hilbert space to its dual. And if I take disjoint unions, that gets assigned to tensor products. And it'll be useful to include among the objects of this TQFT at the empty set, which gets assigned to the complex numbers, which is the field over which our vector spaces is defined. Moreover, cobordisms, which are these manifolds that interpolate between our object, which are the circles and the empty sets, are assigned to linear maps. And these linear maps you're thinking of as some kind of quantum evolution. For example, this hemisphere is a cobordism between the empty set and a circle, and it gives us so a linear map between C and a Hilbert space. But that's really just a choice of a state, so it's a wave function. This linear map between a circle and a circle it really is just the propagator. The important one is this fusion. It takes two circles to one, which means it takes a tensor product of Hilbert spaces into the circle Hilbert space. We can think of this as sort of a multiplication we can define on our Hilbert space. A partition function can be thought of as a map from the empty set to empty set. What is that? It's a linear map from C to C. That's just a number. And the important point is that these basic cobordisms can be glued together along their boundaries. And these gluings correspond to composition of linear maps. So for example, if I take the state defined by disk, I should say now here, time always flows downwards. So I'm starting with the initial state on top and final state in the bottom. So here I've reversed the upper hemisphere into low one, so it gives me a bra. And when I glue them together, I basically just do the inner product of the state, which gives me a number. A composition of a cobordism like this gives you a map that goes from the Hilbert space of one circle into two circles and back to one circle. So this is a basic game that you play with these pictures. And what's interesting is that these pictures tell you some kind of algebraic characterization of the TQFT. For example, we mentioned that this pair of pants is defining a multiplication. But you can see, so of course, we're in a TQFT, so we're free to deform things as we wish. And we can reverse the ordering of the multiplication, and there's no difference. So this is a commutative algebra. This diagram expresses associativity. I can multiply these two elements first, and then with the third one, or the other way around. And moreover, there is a notion of a unit, which is something that what this represented by this cap. When I multiply this cap with any other state, it gives me the cylinder. But in a topological theory, so the cylinder was this evolution operator, but H is the Hamiltonian zero in a topological theory. So a cylinder is really the identity map. We can also define a metric, a symmetric bilinear form on our Hilbert space, given by this macaroni. I can just get it by gluing a cap to the end of the pair of pants. And it's automatic from these pictures that this is invertible, and that it satisfies the invariance condition that makes this into a Frobenius algebra. And so this is just my one slide summary of why people sometimes say that a two-dimensional closed TQFT is a commutative Frobenius algebra. Now, we can also define an open TQFT. So there, we're allowed to think about manifolds with boundaries. In this case, it's just an interval with two endpoints. And the endpoints will have some labeling, which are some just abstract labeling, and will assign a Hilbert space depending on those labelings to each interval. Again, reversing orientation changes from the Hilbert space to its dual, and disjoint Eon gets mapped to tensor products. Now we can play the same game. Again, cobordisms get mapped to linear maps. So this is the open string version of the unit. This is sort of the identity operator. And this is the important cobordism that describes a fusion of two intervals into one. In order for that to happen, the labelings that are connected by, I'll call this sort of a, this is sort of the boundary of the open string. It's sort of the word line traced out by the endpoint of the open string. The labelings have to match. So this is a similar story as the closed case. However, the algebraic characterization is different because the multiplication determined by this open string pair of pants is non-commutative. You can see this by following the evolution of the endpoints. Here on the right-hand side, the outer endpoints go in a loop coming back up, whereas the inner endpoints go down. And on the left-hand side, it's exactly the opposite. However, there's still a unit, which is defined by this cap here. And notice, again, in the open string diagrams, anytime the endpoints are connected by an open string boundary, the labelings have to be the same. So this is also very much like the Champanton indices of an open string road sheet. So this modification has a unit, and it remains associative, even though it's non-commutative. And we can, again, define this bilinear form by gluing a cap, an open disk cap, to the multiplication. And it's, again, symmetric. It satisfies the conditions for this to be a Frobenius algebra. And so that gives you the open string story. Now, what's interesting is that we can have a cobordism that relates both, the open to the closed string TQFG. This is what we call a zipper. It takes a closed string into an open string. And once we introduce the zipper, we introduce a whole new set of objects. Now, our Hilbert spaces can be tensor products of intervals as well as circles. And our cobordisms now look much more fun. Here's an example of a general cobordism that interpolates between initial and final states. Now, what Morse Eagle did was to consider sewing rules that ensures that if I glue together these basic objects in the open and as well as in the closed closed string category, if I glue them together into some final manifold, there might be more than one way of doing it. And these rules ensure that no matter how I do it, I get the same answer. These rules are sort of obvious from a topological point of view. If you look at them, for example, this one just says I can take the zipper and pull it all the way up to the top. And similarly, all these pictures you can see by some kind of topological move that you can make. But they also have an algebraic interpretation. So here, this picture is telling me that the closed unit, which is this cap, gets mapped to the open unit. So this zipper, this I here, is really it's an algebra homomorphism. I should also say that the reason it's a homomorphism is also that it preserves multiplication, which is what this diagram says. Again, these diagrams also have other algebraic interpretations. This one says that the closed strings map into the center of the open strings. What it means is, so if this was just a strip here, we learned before that it's not commutative. But if I start with a closed string and map into an open string state using the zipper, then I can actually do this twisting and reverse the ordering multiplication. And these two diagrams are the same, again, just because if you just follow the movement of the endpoints, you see exactly sort of the same motion. There's a couple of other rules. I would just highlight one of them, which is called the Cardy condition. this maybe looks slightly more general than a usual cardiac condition, but if I glue together, I glue a disc on top of this and this below here, what the left-hand side is, looks like is an annulus, and the right-hand side looks like a cylinder. So it's just saying that an open string moving in a one-loop diagram can also be interpreted as a closed string amplitude. Okay, so what is the main point that we want to make? So we have this open closed CQFT satisfying more Siegel axioms. For them, what they were asking is, given that we have a closed string theory, what are the possible boundaries? That is, what are the possible D-brains? And the answer for them is a D-brain corresponds to an extension of this closed string algebra into an open string algebra that satisfies these constraints. For us, we want to think about the open string algebra that really comes from this pair of pants as a choice of the extension of our Hilbert space and the edge modes that allow us to glue together and split our Hilbert spaces. Let me pause again just to see, are there any questions so far? Okay, yeah?
A short question. So if you have the, like say, a Canterbury system, edge modes are, the edge modes that you can choose are not unique. So you should choose all the edge modes or subset of consistent edge modes that you want.
Yeah. So this, there could be more than one solution. So indeed, given the closed string theory, the possible D-brains are not unique, right? There's more than one open string algebra that would be compatible with the closed string algebra in the sense of satisfying these rules. Yeah.
Sorry. So when you talk about D-brains, so the D usually may stand for Dirichlet, right? So are you assuming that it's always some kind of Dirichlet conditions?
No. They were classifying D-brains. We are not, right?
Yeah. Are you also then talking about other kinds of boundary conditions for your fields that there is about?
So
are you just talking about different types of Dirichlet where like you force your fields
so
to be something?
We should be a little careful here. I mean, we're using the language of string theory, but we're talking about quantum field theory, not string theory, right? So it's sort of fun to talk. I mean, these pictures look like well-cheap pictures, but there's nothing that says that these labelings corresponds to some quote-unquote Dirichlet boundary condition. Really, these are abstract labelings that literally just have to satisfy these rules based on these pictures. So however you define these for me, as long as it satisfies these rules, I would say that it gives a consistent extension of the Hilbert space. Yeah.
So if you're setting the topological limit of 2D angles, then there is a category of boundary controls where the labels are, there's one label given by the Riesz label, one by Neumann. There's other mixed labels. Is that the kind of thing that will appear?
Well, so generically, there might be various choices, but for us, we're going to include this entanglement brain axiom that really fixes sort of one choice in some sense of boundary conditions. I'm not sure whether there's more than one choice of boundary conditions that would fit in this more Siegel story with these five rules, but we sort of have an extra rule because we're thinking about entanglement. And what happens in entanglement is that, let me just say what's on this slide and see if it answers the question. So there's this entanglement brain axiom that says that we're allowed to sort of poke a hole in these pictures. So what happens is that when we talk about the splitting and joining of Hilbert spaces, like this picture here, we're introducing holes into these pictures, right? But these holes, in some sense, correspond to the world line of our entangling surface. And the entangling surface is sort of an imaginary surface, right? So we should be able to close it up. What I mean by that is basically this equation here, that on the right-hand side, I'm thinking about computing the expectation value of an operator in some global state. And there, I would just use a path integral and insert operators without any holes. But on the left-hand side, when I think about a reduced density matrix and computing the same expectation value by inserting, by tracing against the reduced density matrix, I introduce a path integral with holes. And this equation is sort of saying that I can always close up those holes because these two things have to be equal. So let me actually go through this slide one by one, because I think I'm kind of skipping ahead. So first, let me say what the axiom is. The axiom can be formulated either by this picture or that picture, both of which are saying that this kind of window can be closed up. And it implies this, which you see, I put a little E here to represent what I call the entanglement brain axiom. It's telling me that whatever choice I made here allows me to close up these holes. And in particular, it allows me to relate the sphere to the annulus via these steps. So just to say a little more detail, what I meant earlier in my comment about this, if I think about the sphere, there's a way to think of this in the entanglement context. So the hemisphere defines a state on the circle, which is the equator. If I want to think about the entanglement between two halves of the equator, then what I do is I define this reduced density matrix. It's basically a path through on this sphere, but it has a cut on half the equator, where there's some region V on which we want to study entanglement, right? So what this left-hand side is really I can think of as a reduced density matrix. But I have to regulate the boundary. So on the right-hand side, so this interval here is half the equator. And you see the boundaries have been regulated, just like I showed in the earlier slide about the path integral. I open up the entangling surface a little bit. And as a result, the entangling surface is tracing out a codimension one surface as I do the modular flow. And now I have an annulus, right? So these two circles come from the endpoints of my interval. Now, this is in this trace rho v o v picture. If I want to compute a correlation function of operators, I just insert them here, right, in these intervals. But in this picture, I'm computing a thermal expectation value, right? There's a Euclidean circle here, this Euclidean time circle here. So there's a thermal ensemble of sort of open strings where I compute this on the left-hand side. But I know I could have done the same calculation on this side. If I sewed up this cut here, and I could have computed this expectation value just by doing the path integral with some insertions on this equator. And we know they have to be the same. So this entanglement brain's axiom is just enforcing that. And given this axiom, there is sort of one choice of edge modes. And I think, whoops, what have I done? So we'll get to that in a few slides. So I'll show explicitly in Young Mills what Young Mills assigns to this sort of pair of pants. And in some sense, maybe I can say it in a different way. In this story, we're supposed to, given the boundary labelings, I have to assign a Hilbert space. In other words, there's some set of states that's compatible with the boundary conditions. So what we'll do in Young Mills is instead of seeing explicitly what the labelings are, I'm just going to give you the Hilbert space. And that implies what the labelings are at the endpoint. Okay, so are there any other questions?
So,
yeah.
Sir, what types of boundary conditions are concerned? So, Neumann or Hilbert? Or just the ambience?
Okay, I'm not.
If you think about two dimensional, for instance, 8.8 in supersymmetry, then we can expect U1 brains, some U brains, or any symmetry, right? Then we can choose the Neumann or Hilbert for the gauge.
Yeah, so here I'm thinking more that I have, so in two-dimensional Young Mills, I have electric field, there's no magnetic field, and I'm assuming that there's some sense in which I'm summing over all allowed values of the electric field on the boundary. So I'm not sure how to think about this in terms of, so you're using the language of brains, but here we're really just talking about, suppose I quantize on an interval, so I just have to ask what is the value of the electric field at the boundary, right?
Apply for the
I think I'm not sure actually. So yeah, I'm not sure that.
But it's well, I think so. If you think about 2D
ambience,
yeah, it's an important question whether we can choose a Neumann because we can keep the gauge in mind at the boundary for the gap of Neumann, but for the we can keep a gauge. It's a global symmetry.
We're definitely assuming that there is a global symmetry of the boundary. So we're definitely saying that at the boundary there is an action of the gauge group that we treat as a physical symmetry. That's for sure. This is the symmetry that permutes the edge modes at the boundary. Yeah. So, yeah.
you just had a scalar theory,
yeah,
would this entanglement brain axiom give you open boundary conditions?
So my understanding that is, I think I cited Hedrick up in the first slide. I think there they did consider scalar theory, right? And what they were saying is that you should be looking at, say, Dirichlet boundary conditions for the scalar, but you should sum over all Dirichlet boundary conditions.
They were trying to reproduce something else. Like, that paper has too many bells and whistles, I think. So
okay, but would that be? Here. But is that acceptable?
No, it's not.
It's not acceptable to sum over Dirichlet.
Well, it's an acceptable possible answer, but I would be very surprised if that's what you, if that's equivalent to the electric center, which you are arguing for the gauge theory.
Yeah, so, okay, we certainly haven't done...
The same kind of thing that one should think about. I can explain more why later, but
right.
I would be surprised if these two fall in the same intuitive class.
Yeah, so I would say that, yeah, we haven't done this for the scalar, or you know, we've really done this with 2D Young nodes. And the way we formulate 2D Young nodes, which I'll explain in a moment, maybe does not help me answer that question in a very direct way. So maybe at the end of the talk, maybe you will actually tell me the answer to the question. So let me move on to talk about 2D Young nodes. So I want to start with the Hilbert space in a circle. So the configuration space variable we described earlier is this holonomy. And under a gauge transformation, it transforms by conjugation. So the wave functions have to be invariant under gauge transformation. So we have to consider class functions like these. So Hilbert space is just a space of class functions on a gauge group. And these are spanned by Wilson loops, which are just some trace in some representation R of my gauge group. The Hamiltonian is really traced of the electric field squared, and it ends up being proportional to the Casimir operator. It's diagonal in this basis, so we're going to be working mostly in this representation basis. And we can write down the propagator from exponentially this Hamiltonian, and the main point I want to make here is that on the cylinder, we have a circle of length L and length T being combined the two into an area. So this propagator has an area dependence in the exponent here. And we can formulate 2D Young nodes as a closed TQFT. As we said, a circle gets mapped to class functions. The hemisphere is unit element, gets mapped to this state, I'm missing a ket r here. So this is the amplitude for the state. And this is the pair of pants. And you can see there's these Boltzmann factors that depend on area, which came from the propagation that we described earlier. And as a result, when you glue together these pair of pants and these disks, you can get a general path integral on a general Riemann surface. You get the path, you get the partition function, which has an area dependence in this Boltzmann factor, but also has a topological dependence in this dim R factor. This is the dimension of the representation, and the exponent is an order characteristic. Yeah.
Sorry, I have that question. This might be an easy question. So why are the R's all the same in that pair of pants?
Right. So in some sense, I've diagonalized the multiplication here, right? You can, so one way to, so maybe you're asking how to derive this pair of pants, right?
Oh, I generically would have thought it's kind of an OP kind of thing, right? You have R prime and R second.
It would be, so because we've chosen a very nice basis. If I made a change of basis, in fact, this previous work I did with Will, we studied the string theory dual to the Young nodes. And that string theory comes from basically making a change of basis into this quote unquote string basis. In a string basis, this looks much more complicated. So you can think that we start with something that's complicated, that's not diagonal, and we found a nice basis in which this is sort of more or less diagonal. Yeah.
Maybe another way to see it is that R is determined by the electric field locally. So you can, if you wanted to know which state R you're in, you could just do a local measurement at a point of the electric field. put the equation in motion in two-dimensional Yang nulses that can electric field is constant over space-time. So no matter where you do that, it's sort of conserved everywhere.
Right. In fact, that's an important point here. The reason that, so when we get to the calculations, which actually I'm going to run out of time, everything will be simplified because of this fact that we basically diagonalize these modifications. But the point I want to make here is that Yang nulls only depends on the topology and the area of the target space. So now I want to talk about the interval. We have now, instead of Halami on a circle, we have just a Wilson line along an interval as my configuration space variable. The Hilbert space is enlarged to, yeah.
So just as a common answer to somebody else's question, so this is the Hilbert space for Dirichlet bounding conditions?
So.
I mean, because the gauge field vanishes, that's why the Wilson line is qualified.
So should I say the last thing again?
Because the gauge field vanishes at the boundary of the strip, that's why the open Wilson line is well defined, it provides a basis for the Hilbert space with Dirichlet bounding conditions that is generous.
Yeah, so that's probably, so I'm not sure, so I, yeah, so I don't know.
I think it's a standard factor to
do this. Oh, okay, good. So here I'm just going to, so in this TQFT formalism, I get to assign to you a Hilbert space of interval.
But
and here I'm just telling you I'm assigning it to be like this, but you're saying that it comes from Dirichlet. Right, yeah. So I'm assigning a basis of wave functions that corresponds to matrix elements of in some representation R. And there is going to be a boundary symmetry. It comes from the gauge group acting on the left and the right endpoint of the interval, but they act independently. And under that boundary symmetry, my matrix just gets multiplied on the left and the right. So the entangling product is actually quite simple. It just amounts to matrix multiplication. I can start with a state on an interval. There's some holonomy here, some Wilson line here that I can split into two halves. If I think about what happens to my wave function on this whole interval, because this is a matrix in some representation, when I split U into two parts, the matrix just splits into multiplication of two matrices. So this entangling product, this fusion is really just multiplication of matrices. Yeah?
No.
Okay.
I agree.
Okay, good. So I only have about 10 minutes left. So the point here is that we can realize 2D Yang nulls as an open-closed topological quantum field theory. So here, earlier I supplied a formula for, I guess, the opposite of this picture. But we can also supply formulas, say, for the zipper. It's the same idea here that a closed string state, which is a trace in some representation, literally what that trace is RAA sum over A. So this is sort of kind of obvious. The only thing that's tricky is to get the right Demar factors because of normalization. So given this dictionary here, you can start gluing stuff together to get an arbitrary partition function and do calculations and entanglements. I should say that I left out the factors, Boson factors, but so George was asking this question, why is it okay to have this Boson factor? The point is that if I inserted this exponential into these expressions, when I glue together things, then I would just end up adding the areas and everything all works out in terms of the gluing rules. So I want to show them in the last 10 minutes some concrete calculations you can do in this formula. So we can take a state defined on this hemisphere, and we can factorize it into the state of two intervals by doing this kind of this cobordism. And because these bases are all orthogonal, what ends up happening when you do this gluing, you do this kind of gluing of, say, this thing onto this thing, is that you always end up over sum over representations of R, and you always sum over indices, where the indices have to match whenever they're connected by an open string boundary. So in this case, I have a state on these two intervals. The indices A and B here have to, B has to match to this index here, and this A has to match to the other index. I've used one of the more Siegel rules to simplify the top part of this diagram. So it gives me the co-pairing, which is expressed by this tensor factorization. If I want to do the reduced density matrix, I make two copies of my wave function. and then I trace over region V bar, which is just been gluing it. When I do that, I just recover a strip, which is the identity operator. So a simpler way to think about this tracing out procedure, which we use for later, is that there's a state channel duality. I can always take a quantum state, which is this upper macaroni here. I can always flip one of the kets into a bra to think about this as a linear map instead of a state. And then the density matrix, in terms of this linear map, is just psi dagger. This allows a little more efficient way to get the density matrix from the wave function. The effective partition function I was talking about just comes from tracing the density matrix. So I start with this strip here, and tracing just means I glue the two ends together to make a annulus. And here's a nice illustration of this entanglement brain axiom. So here I have to sum over all the boundaries. I have two of them. And the sum goes from 1 to the dimension of R. So when I sum over these indices, I get these Demar factors. But this sum over Demar is exactly the partition function on a sphere. So this is the concrete way in which this entanglement brain axiom is realized. It's really that when you sum over boundary edge degrees of freedom, you recover exactly the right Demar factors to get this sphere partition function. And finally, from this, you can get the entanglement tree by writing it in a thermal form. We can also talk about the same story with multi-intervals. This is sort of the more interesting case. I have the same state prepared by a hemisphere, but now I split it twice. So first into two intervals, then to four. And I want to think about the state reduced to the blue intervals. So eventually, I want to trace out the states on the red interval. But from what we said before, the easy way to thinking, instead of thinking about tracing out, we just use a state channel duality to define a linear map that goes from the blue intervals into the red interval. If you do that, if you sort of flip the blue intervals into bras, then you get a diagram like this. And what's interesting about this diagram is if you follow the flow of these indices, you see that what it does is it takes the initial interval pair of intervals, and it swaps the indices. So here, B is paired to A, and the final state, B is paired to C. Here's D is paired to C, the final state, B is paired to A. So it's sort of a swap operator that swaps the edge indices. And there's also a Demar factor here. It comes from the fact that every time you have one of these open pair of pants, there's always 1/√ of Demar. So once you have this sort of half the modulo flow, which is psi, you can write down the total modulo flow by writing psi dagger. So here's a diagram expression of that. What I did here is we start with the blue intervals, you evolve into the complement, and then you start with the complement and evolve back to the blue intervals. It gives you identity, but up to a factor of Demar. And from that, we can read off the modular Hamiltonian. It's just the log of Demar minus 2. And we can also read off the partition function. And again, there's this entanglement brain axiom in which here we have a partition sum over not just R, but four indices corresponding to the four endpoints of the intervals. So these are the extra edge modes I get whenever I split the interval into more intervals. But if you sum over all the edge modes first, you always recover the sphere partition function. And from here, again, the formula is just flow. You can always get the entropy just by using the formula minus trace rho log rho. In here, I just use the fact that that's the sum of the eigenvalues, say rho I log rho I. But I want to mention one thing that's interesting about this diagram. So this diagram that involves the splitting and joining of strings and trading their endpoints actually should be thought of as some kind of settle point. If you think about this top two open strings here, as they evolve past the settle point, they have swapped partners. In the bottom part of this diagram, the open strings have reconnected in a different way. So I'll come back to this diagram later in the conclusion. But I want to mention that, actually, let me pause for a second because I feel I'm rushing. And rather than rush, I would like to at least explain one of these calculations in detail. So are there any questions about this calculation? Okay. Let me keep going. So we can also discuss negativity. So negativity is a useful measure of entanglement at finite temperature, but it involves computing something called the partial transpose. So here I have a density matrix. I want to compute this rho to the gamma refers to the partial transpose of rho. What this means is that, so rho is defined on these two regions. I take one of the regions, and I do a transpose only on those on that region. And now the negativity is defined to be log of trace of the partial transpose of rho. So that looks like a difficult thing to calculate, but the trick is to use a replica trick. Here I take trace of the partial transpose of rho, but raised to some even power n, n e. I can also introduce the same thing for odd number n o. And the point here is that this gives me even power. So if I think about the eigenvalues of rho, this is summing over eigenvalues of rho squared or rho to the fourth, and that those who pick out the absolute, when I analytically continue n e to one, it's going to pick out the absolute value of the eigenvalues. But all these density matrices are not normalized, so I have to divide by some normalization factor here. So the only purpose of this odd trace rho to the odd power is that when n0 goes to 1, it just gives me the normalization factor. So this gives a practical way of computing negativity. And the main point I want to make is that if I consider negativity diagrams, I also get the kind of swapping operator we saw with the multi-interval modular flow. So here is a density matrix defined on two intervals. If I do this operation here, so I flip this bra into a ket and vice versa, I get this partial transpose, which is exactly the same diagram as we saw before here. So it has the same property that, right, so it sort of exchanges one of the endpoints. One of the two intervals. And what's interesting here is that, we can calculate the negativity, and it turns out that this is some expression in terms of expectation value. But I want to just point out one interesting about the diagram, which is that if you take even power, so this is two copies of the density matrix, you get an expression here for even even powers of rho. Trace rho to the origin even power that's different than odd powers. And the reason is that if you follow the boundaries here, the number of boundaries differ. So even though there are four endpoints, when you follow the boundaries, in this case, there are four circles. But in this case, two of the boundaries, if I follow, say, this one, it connects, so the boundary traced out by the second endpoint here connects to the boundary traced up by the fourth endpoint here. And if you go through the calculation, you get a different expression for the odd and even partitioning functions. So we can calculate this negativity by doing this replica trick. And what's interesting is if I define a probability distribution like so, this really looks very much like almost the same as the sphere, as the probability distribution on the sphere. This negativity is counting log of the expectation value with respect to this probability distribution of dim r. So in other words, the dim r is counting the number of edge modes we have. So this negativity is isolating the part of the isolating a contribution due to edge degrees of freedom. And in the final 2 minutes I have, I want to mention some conclusions and future directions. So we discuss entanglement in 2D Young nodes in terms of open, closed, extended TQFT. We can also apply the same framework to the string theory dual. In that context, there is actually a worksheet interpretation of this entanglement brain. This entangling surface is actually a place where open string ends. So it's natural to ask, can we do the same for 2D CFTs? For the case of the free fermion, this interpretation of this modular flow of two intervals as its cobordism actually was helpful in computing exactly this modular Hamiltonian of two intervals. The idea is that in the path integral sort of description of two interval modular flow, what happens is that we have to study how two intervals sweep out this space-time. That's really a plane or a sphere if you add the point infinity. And it was noticed by Cardi and Tawney that when you do that, these two intervals meet an obstruction. They kind of run into each other at this point. However, the modular flow sort of continues past this point because you can cut and reglue the two intervals. So the left part of this interval glues to the right part of the other interval, and the right part of the left interval glues to the left part of the right interval. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we saw in this cobordism here. So even though the free fermions is not a TQFT, this framework of cobordisms and extended TQFT is still useful because it gave sort of a conceptual framework behind how to understand this modular flow in the case of free fermion CFT. Another obvious extension is to higher dimensions. This whole formalism works of extended TQFT works in any higher dimensions. So one might ask, can we apply the same ideas to, say, transcendental theory? And finally, it's tempting to ask if we can succeed in applying this formalism to CFTs, can we consider the bulk dual? And I think I'm basically out of time, so I want to just end here and allow for questions. Yeah.
So you started out by sort of pointing out that, like, without factorization, okay, you started out by talking about things like entanglement and the fact that the choice of boundary of edge modes wasn't unique. So then, like, at the end of the day, how much do the answers depend on this boundary condition, this extension to an open closed string?
Are you referring to 2D Yang-Mills in this case?
In the exam, sure. Well, like.
Yeah, so I'm a little confused about this. So in 2D Yang-Mills, given that I included this E-brain axiom,
okay.
I think it seems like it's not clear to me if there are other choices. So I've told you, like, so this, I specified the Hilbert space here that's compatible with that E-brain axiom, and I don't know of another solution. But in a conformal field theory, according to Cardi, so a free fermion is also conformal field theory. According to Cardi, we should really put conformally invariant boundary conditions at the endpoints of the intervals. So there, those are not unique, right? There's maybe a finite number of them for a rational CFT. And then you can ask, right, does that work inside this? So in fact, I think that would naturally satisfy a Cardi condition, right? So I think there you have more choices. Than in Yang.
Like when you try to calculate the entropy,
is
the answer you get?
The subleading term, so if you take the leading term in entanglement entropy, it's like log L over epsilon. It doesn't seem to depend on the boundary state, on the boundary condition. But there's a subleading term that's not dependent on the size of the interval. And that actually would depend on the choice of boundary conditions.
So that's a CFT, and I should say here, it may be that there different ways of extending to an open sector. But if you assume this, that you can sew up holes, then in fact the answer for any entanglement or negativity calculation is unique. Because once you write down these sort of expanded diagrams with boundaries, you can then go and just close up all the boundaries and get a closed thing. And that answer is not dependent on what you chose for the open sector. So it may be that there is another choice to make, but if there is, it has to have exactly the same counting of states and exactly the same entanglement. So it's a very constrained thing. And I suspect that there isn't another choice, but we have to
ship that. Okay, I have a related question, which is that when you initially say that there is some choice to be made, that you sort of fix that choice by choosing the entanglement axiom. Is there any other entanglement axiom you can think of, the entanglement axiom that you can think of, given these other choices?
I agree that this one is a very natural one, the way you phrase it, but there should exist others that will fix other choices. Like in the gauge theory, you should be able to fix the normal conditions in some way.
Sure, and you're asking, is there some like diagrammatic, you know, action that I can say that
it's not
that picks up Neumann boundary conditions or some other favorite boundary conditions? It's not obvious to me what that would be.
And the second thing I should say, by the way, when you talk about card states, I'm pretty sure that this choice will pick one card state, and there's other choices.
When you say this choice, you mean the Ibrin.
Yeah, the choice of the entanglement text, you will pick one card state.
Yeah, no, I'm actually confused by this because, to be honest, none of the card states are the value. So the entanglement brain axiom seems to say that you always glue a disk to that whole deck,
yeah.
Right? But a disk is sort of, that's like putting nothing there, right? That's like putting. But all the Cardi states are these Ishibashi states that have more than just the value. They're not the same. Yeah. So but I think what will happen, as we were saying, so this trace this condition, you always get that, you know, trace rho v over v is always expectation value over v. That's always true. But somehow in the case of conformal field theory, it seems like there's a subleading part of the entanglement entropy that would depend on the different choices of Cardi states.
Yeah.
But they're not the vacuum. They're not all the vacuum, right? The different choices. None of them are actually vacuum.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that at least have this one example, which I'm sure Bill knows about, where we actually know the correspondence between the lattice boundary conditions and the CFD ones for the Ising model, like the one plus one dimensional critical Ising model. We know the correspondence, and therefore the lattice, the open boundary conditions correspond to precisely the sigma Cardi state.
Okay.
And this is seen in the Rengi entropies, which you can calculate. So
I see. Okay, good, okay.
And it's known also, like the dictionary was completed, essentially. We know that the one and epsilon Cardi states correspond to essentially Dirichlet boundary conditions there.
I see.
So that's why I do not expect that your choice of the entanglement brain axiom will encompass many Cardi states, maybe a subset.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I mean, should I say there's something about this that requires UV finite? I mean, it's related to UV finite because Yang-Mills is finite in the UV, right? So you can basically close up these holes without any punishment. But in the entanglement entropy calculation for CFT, there's a divergence that comes from the entangling surface. So when you close up that hole, you get infinity. So somehow I'm not confident that this entanglement brain axiom necessarily carries over exactly the same. Maybe Will has a different idea, but I don't know.
You have some sides of this thing. Here we could just take a finite circle and put a boundary condition. Obviously, that's not what you're going to do in CFT. You're going to take something that is epsilon.
Right. I mean,
zero
in CFT, so yeah.
But
I think there should be some version of that where you basically say, as you shrink this thing, you know, it doesn't matter what correlation function you calculated. You put some little circle with boundary condition, and as you shrink it, your correlation functions go back to the ones that you would have had without putting that on the surface there.
Sure, I agree with that. Any other?
Yeah. I mean, so these examples, it seems like a Carroll Fermi. It seems like it's going to be very difficult to find an entanglement boundary condition. Because suppose I say, take a local boundary condition of psi prime, say psi vanishes. But that's a state which is infinitely far away from the vacuum.
Actually, did you say chiral fermion?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that you can so people always complain, so for a chiral fermion, it's not clear that you can have a factorized, you mean one chiral fermion?
One chiral fermion, you can put a pair, one complex fermion. I mean, you do not need a factorizable Hilbert space for your story here, so ideally you would not need a factorizable Hilbert space for a chiral fermion. But it is a mystery why you get the one half in the chiral fermion entanglement entropy. No one really. I would say that. I mean, you.
I include the extended Hilbert space as what I mean by when I say factorized Hilbert space. I would say that extending my Hilbert space and then factorizing is also legal, right? So you have to. If you talk about entanglement, if you want to talk about entanglement, you have to do something like that, right?
Sure, but
so
then what's wrong with chiral fermion?
I don't know how to do it. That's, I mean, maybe it's not.
I mean, if you could do this, then basically you can construct a lattice description of the theory, right? It's like you can chop it up into a bunch of intervals and then just, you know, treat each one of the, you know, the Hilbert space of a small interval as your lattice, I think, right? So, a couple of these different. So if you have a theory where that, I mean, yeah, I don't know how to do that. But yeah, it's not clear that, that every theory should admit something like this. It's not that. These ones do, and a lot of theories do. It's interesting when you do, I don't know that it's something that always, this axiom can always be satisfied.
I think the Clavio topological sigma models also don't.
Okay.
Entangled
brains. Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay. Let's thank Pedro again.